Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming out to this important event. We really appreciate it. I'm Rio Davidson, and we are Lincoln County Community Rights. You know, this is a very special moment for us, not only to have you here, but to have Thomas Lindsay in Newport. I want to give you a quick history of how we got to this moment. So, most of us met starting working together back in the Occupy Newport days. Back then, we got an advisory question to basically say we wanted to put a stop to corporate personhood. And we won Lincoln County by about 70% of the vote. And we felt really strongly about that, and we were pretty proud. You know, worked hard on it. You know, the only thing was that we didn't feel like we got much out of it. And we really started thinking about, you know, where we were headed as a group and a community. So we started talking to a bunch of other progress and reform-minded groups around Oregon, and you know, we found the Oregon Community Rights Network. So that network's made up of six different counties that have all come together under the community rights movement to start making local change in their communities. We plugged into that network. And since then, we've been organizing our Lincoln County Community Rights Group and pursuing our goals along this path for over 2 years now. This network of county groups has been working together to make meaningful changes to our laws concerning matters of GMOs, seed production, LNG pipelines, and of course, pesticide spraying. Our special guest speaker tonight, Thomas Lindsay, will soon be explaining the who, what, and why of it all for most of the rest of the evening. But first, a quick status report for those of you impatient. We have already filed an ordinance to ban the aerial spraying of pesticides here in Lincoln County. Copies are available online and at our table back here. We're now waiting for a court ruling before we can canvass for signatures to put it before the Lincoln County voters in our next election. This is the first step in a long process of taking back our democracy. Together, we're going to work to make Lincoln County safe for all our citizens, denizens, and passersby, especially the folks that live in or near the industrial forest. We need your support, both financial and physical, from donors and volunteers. Lincoln County Community Rights is offering a pamphlet written by Thomas Lindsay for a donation of $10 or more. Please donate. We did just figure that if you want to make a larger contribution, that we do have a 501(c)(3) that we can use. So if you do want to make a larger contribution, let one of our members know and we can make sure you can get your tax deduction on that. We have a volunteer sign-up sheet and donation envelopes on your seats, easily placed there. This movement is already going full speed, and costs are starting to add up. We have been working for years to develop a relationship with you, our family. Together, we can spread our message to all of Lincoln County and change our government, even take control of our own government. We would be happy to come talk with you and or your group, your community group. We're going to be looking to talk with different groups, including churches, activist groups, you know, reading clubs. You know, we're available here. And you'll also be able to hear more about us on KYAQ 91.7. I would like to introduce Kai Huschka. He is the regional Northwest organizer for CELDIF, the national organization that Mr. Lindsay will be talking about, that is encouraging and supporting the network of local community rights groups across the country today.
We'll get to the main show here in a second. My name is Kai Huschka, as Riel said. I am the organizer for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund for this part of the country. I thought just to give a little bit of background about our organization, a little bit more about the ORCRN and sort of what that all means, because it's all going to make sense in relation to what Thomas is going to talk about tonight. The Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is a nonprofit law firm, technically. We do law work, but we also do organizing work and education work. We work actively in about 10 to 12 different states now. Have worked with probably 500 or 600 different communities, always with this question about why are we not being able to make the decisions in our own communities, especially around critical issues. And this has ranged through a whole bunch of different issues, whether it's been fracking, LNG pipelines, factory farms, land application of sewage sludge, pesticides, GMOs, you name it. Even economic issues around worker rights, other community issues like land development. What all these communities have in common is they're all running into the same structural reality, which unfortunately is that you are not the decision maker in your own community around these critical issues. And tonight's about unpacking a lot of that, understanding where that history comes from, but more importantly, the application today when communities run into these situations, you know, what are they doing about it? And the community rights movement is about actually getting themselves into a new arena and actually restructuring their own government to recognize people's right to govern, which sounds like a crazy thing to say, because we thought we were founded on that sort of scenario from the get-go, but yet when we run into it, especially into the realm of corporate projects, we see that we actually don't. So what's happening here in Lincoln County is nothing short of extraordinary, and it's nothing short in a lot of ways of actually a revolution of sorts happening between communities and corporations, but also communities in their own structure of government. As Rio also mentioned, to help support all what's happening here and other places, these community rights networks have been formulated, Oregon being one of these places where these communities are coming together. So these are communities that may have had different issues, whether it's been pipelines or coal trains or pesticides, but they're understanding they're dealing with a structural democracy problem and have come together to start dealing with that, as well as supporting each other on the local level. Oregon's one of these places where that revolution of sorts is now moving up to the state level. There's now a state constitutional amendment to recognize the right of local community self-government. Thomas will get into more about what that means, but this is, in essence, the buildup of that, the next wave of where it's coming up from the community level. In addition to that, these state community rights networks have started to come together to look at national constitutional change, federal constitutional change, because as we'll hear, this stuff is DNA to that specific level. It's not just your own state government. And often, it seems crazy to say, but when these corporate harms are happening, or when it comes to communities trying to move in a very different direction, you're not running up against the corporate entity itself. You're actually running into your own constitution, your own U.S. constitution that's limiting you and your ability to actually have democratic decision-making power in your community. So we'll hear more about what that actually looks like. And as it's been mentioned, the book here that's in the back, really, the talk tonight is all encapsulated in large degree in this particular book for those who want to leave here and sort of absorb more of what you're hearing. The book itself is a keen, easy way to sort of get a general sense, not only the community level stuff, but the structural stuff and where this is all moving to. So that's a little bit more about where things sit, both here in Oregon and other places. You'll hear some other stories. After the talk, I'm going to have the Lincoln County Community Rights Group come up again to talk a little bit more about what's happening, more specifics, and then we'll have some Q&A for folks to ask questions of Thomas as well as the local folks, and I'm happy to answer any questions as well. So since you didn't come here to see me and hear me speak, I'm going to hand it off to Thomas here, but to give you a little bit more background about who Thomas is. Thomas Lindsay is an attorney and the executive director for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which I'd mentioned is we are a nonprofit providing free legal services. We work with probably a couple hundred, 500-600 different communities now to this point. He is admitted to practice in the United States Supreme Court, the 3rd, 4th, 8th, and 10th Circuit Courts of Appeals, the U.S. District Court for the Western and Middle Districts of Pennsylvania, and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Mother Jones, The Nation magazine, and he was named in 2007 as one of Forbes magazine's top 10 revolutionaries. Thomas currently lives in Spokane, Washington. Thomas Lindsay.
Thank you, Kai Hushka. I think we're on the fifth day of our tour at this point, so we're getting kind of tired of hotel rooms. But this tour isn't possible without the groups on the ground that are making it happen. And so a big thank you tonight to the Lincoln County Community Rights Group. Yay. And specifically to Maria, Rio, Barbara, Jerry, John, all the folks on the ground here that are making it happen in Lincoln County. So we're going to talk about a lot of difficult stuff tonight. Okay? And when we talk about difficult stuff, especially constitutional law stuff, you would think that the most likely group to have that conversation with would be lawyers, you know, my peers in the legal industry. And I've tried for a number of years to actually explain to that peer group, my peer group, exactly what's happening here, which is essentially people on the ground level are saying, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to be controlled by corporate rights. We're not going to be controlled by state legislatures when they tell us what we can and can't do. And it's unfortunate, but the lawyers, I think, are the last ones to join the revolution train. And so when I try to explain it to them, you know, I try to relay to them what's happening at the grassroots level, that what I get back is just this puzzled look. Because in the legal world, the folks that make change are not you. The folks that make change, at least in their heads, are silver-tongued lawyers making arguments to judges. And so I finally got really exasperated. I was speaking to a group of lawyers a couple months ago, and I was reminded of a T-shirt that I had just seen, which says, I can explain it to you, but I can't understand it for you. And so I came to that point with my community, which I think is probably the last one to make this type of change. So I said we're going to talk about some difficult things tonight. I'm actually going to start with talking about this question of whether we live in a democracy or not. So that's going to touch on a bunch of stuff that happened in our history around the U.S. Constitution. We're going to move through that stuff, then put a pin in that, and then begin talking about how folks are starting to run into that structure, the U.S. structure of law. So as Kai said, they don't necessarily run into Smithfield Foods or Hatfield Foods or Monsanto first when they attempt to do something like ban GMOs or ban fracking or take action at the local level. You actually run into your own structure of government first. So what's that about? That's one of the things that we're going to be talking about. And then we're going to talk about why environmental activism in this country has been such a failure. Because environmental activism in this country is basically built around that constitutional structure, which is one of the reasons why it's been so ineffective over the past 45 years. And in fact, we make the statement sometimes that there's never been an environmental movement in the United States because it's based on activism that respects this property-based system that the U.S. Constitution put into place. And then we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about what is happening in other places to take on that structural issue. So not just beg for better water or better air, but actually moving forward to dismantle that system that's in place that stops us from doing things on the ground to protect our families and our communities. So just to start that adventure out, as we were preparing for this talk, I was reminded that 7 years ago, we were on the stump talking about how we don't live in a democracy. And a lot of people looked at us crazy and laughed and said, that's funny. Of course, we live in a democracy. We have a House and a Senate, and we have state legislature, and we vote for people. And of course, we have a democratic system that operates in the United States. Well, it's funny, over the past year or so, these different examples of things that have started coming out. For example, Princeton University put out a study just 2 months ago in which they looked at 1,800 policy decisions across the United States that were made over the past 20 years. And their point in looking at that was to see whether we, the people, you know, ordinary, average people and communities, really had any influence whatsoever over how those policy decisions were made. And what the folks at Princeton found was that we don't. That sometimes when our interests are parallel to the interests of the, you know, elite industrial folks that are making those decisions for us at various levels, that they run in the same direction. But Princeton, when they came out with the study, put out a press release and a headline that said, Americans don't live in a democracy anymore. I mean, that was the press release. And I think I was reminded somewhat of some of what their study showed when, you know, just this past week, Shell Oil decided to pull out of Alaska from drilling in Alaska. and they decided to pull out of Alaska from drilling because they discovered that there wasn't enough recoverable reserves of oil and gas to actually drill. To which, I don't know about you, but the next morning my email box was full of emails from national environmental groups who were claiming victory, that was a victory for the environmental groups because they had put pressure on Shell and somehow that had resulted in the decision. But I guess it reminded me of, you know, who are we kidding? It's actually a failure of environmental law that there was no other way to stop Shell from actually drilling in Alaska except for Shell to discover that there were dry holes in Alaska and decide it wasn't worth their time or money. Two other examples, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was speaking in Egypt a couple months ago. She was on this tour and reporters asked her point blank, they said, Justice Ginsburg, if you were to write a new constitution today, you were in a new country, new nation, writing a new constitution, what model would you use to actually write that constitution? And she said, certainly not the U.S. Constitution, right? So that's the first time I have ever heard that coming from a Supreme Court justice. And then Pope Francis, of all people. You know, Pope Francis comes over, talks about elites controlling government. I think I almost fell out of my chair when he used the phrase rights of nature, because one of the things we work on is ecosystems having rights and having a right to exist and those types of things. I think I almost bowled over at that point when that statement was made. So, to start this difficult conversation, even though people are starting to talk about the fact that we don't live in a democracy and coming to some of the same conclusions that we've come to, and others, of course, one thing that we're still saying, which is new in many ways, that's not being echoed in any other chambers, is that we talk about that this place was never intended to be a democracy. And that's a completely different thing. It's one thing to believe that we had a democracy but lost it. It's a whole other thing to understand that this place was never intended to be a democracy. Those are two different problem statements. And of course, we had the American Revolution, where founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine, the more radical founding fathers of the time, were saying things like the American Revolution was actually about not only throwing England off as the owner of what became the United States, but that the purpose of the American Revolution was actually to throw out English law, the English structure of law that had been built, that the revolutionaries were also rebelling against. Because as Thomas Paine said, it wouldn't make any difference if we broke away from England if we just put the same system of law in place that England had, right? Doesn't make us any better, just makes us independent, but it doesn't make us any better from a structure of law standpoint. We also think sometimes, at least I did, that the Constitution came out of nowhere, just dropped from the sky, that the founding fathers were the best and brightest people that ever trod the planet, that they got together in a building and they came up with this Constitution that had so many lovely things in it. We forget that the genesis of the U.S. Constitution happened 5 years before the Constitution was actually drafted in Philadelphia's Constitutional Hall back in 1789, so 5 years before that, that George Washington, of all people, began to collect and gather small groups of his associates in the United States, keeping in mind that George Washington owned 63,000 acres of land in the United States at the time. So he was one of the biggest, wealthiest landowners in the United States. And he was having problems developing his land through the building of canals, which had to run through both Maryland and Virginia, because the legislatures of Maryland and Virginia were arguing about with each other about whether to allow George Washington to build those canals or not. And no shirker of perhaps a corporate subsidy type of system, George Washington was not only asking them to approve the canals, he wanted state taxpayer monies to pay for the canals to actually develop those 63,000 acres. So he wasn't shy about asking those questions. Because he was held up for a number of years by these state legislatures arguing over whether to provide those canals to him, whether to pay for them, he began to gather groups of associates to ask them to join him in a crusade to actually create a federal constitution that would take commerce power and actually lodge it at the federal government level in a way that could overturn states when states attempted to interfere with commerce. And George, of course, was a product of his times, which was in the 1780s, the biggest hurdle, the biggest focus of the founding fathers, at least of George's type and tenure, was to create a governing structure that looked out at this endless bounty of natural resources in what would become the United States and find a way to exploit those resources the fastest way possible, to turn them into goods and products so that the United States could become a world power. Okay? And they were not shy about that. They talked about that in Philadelphia Convention Hall and everywhere else. And I have to say that 1780 structure of law has worked very well because its purpose was to do exactly what it's done, which is that exploitation of natural resources across the United States and to centralize that commerce power at the federal level away from you, away from communities and away from states and away from other levels of government except for the federal government. We also forget that the U.S. Constitution in Philadelphia, they locked the doors. They had armed sentries outside. They wouldn't allow any of the debates to actually be distributed outside of Constitution Hall. And the notes about what happened during those days in the 1780s didn't get distributed for 54 years. So no notes of it. Try our, you know, right to know act request on that one. You know, 54 years later, people actually learned what had happened behind those closed doors. And in fact, the founding fathers that we think of as the architects of the Constitution, like James Madison, were no fans of democracy. And don't take our word for this. You can actually buy the minutes, the debate notes about what happened in Philadelphia Constitutional Convention. A little bit of light reading. But people like James Madison made statements like the purpose of the U.S. Constitution was to put the minority of the opulent over the majority. Okay? Madison's own words. Put the minority of the opulent over the majority. And to build a U.S. constitutional structure that for the first time in the United States created a centralized, preemptive federal government that had control over all issues of commerce. Keeping in mind that in the United States today, the courts have defined almost anything as commerce. GMOs, pesticide spraying has been defined as commerce. Fracking, commerce. Frack wastewater injection wells, commerce. Shipping, commerce. Basically, any issue that you can think of that environmental groups work on has been defined as commerce by the courts, thus lifting it out to that federal level of jurisdiction. We also forget a couple other things before we move on to the work that started to happen against all of this, that the U.S. Constitution created a House, a Senate, a President, and a Supreme Court. Well, the House of Representatives that the U.S. Constitution created was to be elected by the people, but only the people that were people at the time of the U.S. Constitution, right? That didn't include women, didn't include African Americans, didn't even include white men without property. So you had to be a white male with property qualifications to even participate in the election of the House. The U.S. Senate was actually appointed by state legislatures. Those state legislatures, of course, consisted only of people that were people at the time, not women, African Americans, white males without property. When you crunch the numbers between all of these different levels that were driven into the Constitution about who could participate in the 1780s after the U.S. Constitution was adopted, who could participate in the electoral process or the political process, the numbers come out to a little less than 4%. So 4% of all the people that were living in what became the United States could actually participate through voting or running for office or do those things that a political life entails. So less than 4% were democratized by the U.S. Constitution. J. Allen Smith, a historian around the turn of the century, basically called out the U.S. Constitution, as some other historians and writers have done over the years. He said, point blank, constitutional government is not necessarily democratic. So just because we have a constitution, it doesn't mean we have a democracy, right? I used to equate those two in my head. Well, if you have a constitution, you're a country. It means you're a democracy. No, sadly, it doesn't. J. Allen Smith also said that the U.S. Constitution stood in inherent opposition to democracy. So it was actually a document, as he explained, to create checks and balances between the major economic forces. But those checks and balances have nothing to do with democracy, because they're only about checks and balances between a certain number of people who are in a position to make policy and who are powerful enough to be in that position. So before we leave the U.S. Constitution, again, putting a pin in this, because we're going to come back to this relatively complicated stuff to talk about what folks are doing to actually understand that structure and confront it, is that we don't want to leave you with the feeling that we extol no parts of the Constitution. Of course, the Bill of Rights to the Constitution is this extremely valuable and extremely historical and extremely excellent piece of work. The only problem is that the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution had to be driven in over the objections of the founding fathers in the United States. States and state ratifying conventions had to refuse to ratify the U.S. Constitution, which was only ratified by the slimmest of margins, by saying, we will only adopt this if a Bill of Rights is included. So it took a counter-revolution of sorts just to get the Bill of Rights in. But it did nothing to change the text of the Constitution, the way that the system actually functions. It was an add-on. It's kind of like the environmental side agreements to NAFTA and GATT and the international trade agreements, which don't really change the functioning of the trade agreement itself. They're really add-ons to the end. The Bill of Rights was really an add-on to that constitutional structure that the founders eventually relented and allowed into the constitutional structure so it would be ratified. Now, you may be thinking, all that is well and good. You know, this criticism of how the U.S. constitutional structure is set up and what it does and what the intent was. Most people don't sit in their living rooms on Wednesday nights or any nights thinking about the U.S. Constitution and thinking about its shortcomings because it's not that relevant to them in an imminent, immediate sense. It's more abstract or academic. The problem is that the folks that are talking about the constitutional structure today the most are the folks that are on the receiving end of corporate projects coming into their communities. These corporations who are empowered by the constitutional structure to come into the communities to do X, Y, and Z. So for example, fracking in Colorado. One of the statistics, I was just out in Colorado, one of the statistics that floored me was that one county in Colorado now has issued 19,000 gas frack well permits. So one county, 19,000 frack well permits in one county, okay? So folks living in communities in Colorado have been facing off against fracking as well as in other states. Harms, of course, are water pollution, climate change, I mean, the whole realm of different issues that you run into when you have a frack well next to your house. Corporate hog factory farms, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the United States. Agriculture has been corporatized in the United States. Five corporations now control 80% of pork production. Four corporations control 70% of poultry production in the United States. One corporation controls 60% of cheese production. It's not Tillamook. It's Kraft Foods, 60% of cheese production in the United States. Genetically modified organisms, seeds and crops, especially in Oregon, from an Oregon perspective, Benton and Lane counties. Fighting GMOs and folks in Jackson and Josephine as well, dealing with that corporatization of agriculture in which seeds are now owned and patented so that the farmers don't even own their own seeds anymore. It reminds me of these corporate hog factory farms where the farmers own the hogs when they enter into a contract with one of the big corporations. The corporation has title to the hogs that the farm is raising. Unless the hogs die while under contract, and title reverts back to the farmer to eliminate or dispose of the hog. So it's the same kind of corporate system. Corporate water bottling operations in New Hampshire and elsewhere. Nestle coming into New Hampshire to stick straws in the ground and suck water out of aquifers to bottle and sell to Italy, which was the plan for Nestle in New Hampshire before folks rose up and actually stopped that project. So all these harms coming in through these various corporate projects that are very imminent. They're a crisis. They're an emergency. They're coming into a community, and the community wants to say no. You know, the community wants to say, we just don't want that water bottling operation or that frack job or whatever the project being proposed is. And what happens when they rise up to say no is that they run into a system of law that doesn't allow them to say no. And that's always the toughest thing to talk to community groups about, because there's this myth in the United States that communities, municipalities, municipal communities like towns, villages, counties, boroughs, townships, those entities and people within them, have the power to frontally say no to corporate projects coming in. So that you can pass a one paragraph ordinance that says no big box stores within our community, or can pass a one paragraph ordinance that says no frack wells in the community. The problem is that whether you're dealing with fracking or GMOs or pesticide spraying or water bottling operations, that if you try to say no to those projects within your community by passing a one-paragraph thing that says we're not going to allow that use in our community, that you get sued. And you get sued by the affected corporation, the corporation affected by that decision that you've made, generally on two grounds. The first ground is something called preemption. So this concept we all learn in high school and college about the federal government preempting the state preempting the local. Most states have things in place like state oil and gas acts, which explicitly divest municipal communities of the authority to pass any laws that interfere with that state regulatory authority. So when you look at the State Oil and Gas Act in Colorado, for example, it says that municipalities are explicitly prohibited from adopting any ordinances that regulate gas operations within their community. So this concept of preemption. I shouldn't need to explain preemption to you guys because your Oregon legislature passed the Monsanto Protection Act not long ago, which bans municipalities from controlling or regulating genetically modified seeds and crops within municipal jurisdictions outside of one county in Oregon. Bottling operations. Most states have water resources laws. Those water resources laws ban municipalities from controlling groundwater withdrawal. They centralize that regulatory authority at the state level, but divest it from the municipal level. So preemption, a lot of people don't understand, is that just because the state legislature passed a preemptive law, it's not that the state directly enforces that law. The entity that directly enforces that law is the corporation that is now affected by your municipal law saying that they can't do a certain thing within the community. So corporations weaponize the preemptive provisions. They work with the legislatures to pass them first to divest that authority from municipalities. And then they weaponize it by suing the community for exceeding their authority because the preemptive law divests them of that authority in the first place. That's how the arguments occur. And when we think about preemption, you know, the conversation about preemption has become stilted as well. But when a state has an oil and gas act in place that preempts your municipality from stopping fracking or some other oil and gas drilling project, what that state law is doing is mandating that fracking occur in every municipality, right? That's what the preemptive law does. It doesn't just divest authority. It's a proactive act of mandating that those activities can occur in every municipality within the state. So it's got that proactive component to it. The other reason municipalities get sued is that their ban, whatever they're passing at the local level, that one paragraph that says no factory farms or no bottling operation or no Walmart, runs afoul of something called corporate constitutional rights. Today in the United States, corporations have constitutional rights. It's a result of a series of decisions made by the Supreme Court. And as I'm going to talk about in a minute, it's a natural place for corporations to fall within our constitutional structure in some ways because of the way it's built. But corporations have the same rights as you or I, for the most part, under the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights. They have First Amendment constitutional rights, free speech rights. It was those free speech rights that a couple corporations used to overturn campaign finance law in the Citizens United case, the now infamous Citizens United case. Corporations have claimed religious protections under the Hobby Lobby decision that the Supreme Court issued, so as persons under the First Amendment. Corporations have Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. It's why our regulatory agencies can't do unannounced inspections of workplaces, because there's no warrant, there's no probable cause that supports those unannounced inspections. So that's a Fourth Amendment right that corporations have. In addition to that, corporations have takings rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which means that if a regulation, like an environmental wetlands regulation, interferes with a corporation's property, that they can sue the municipality that's passed the regulation or the state for damages in the form of takings, because the corporation has had its property taken under the Fifth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment requires just compensation to be paid for takings of the property of persons. In addition to that, we have the Commerce Clause within the U.S. Constitution, which elevated all issues related to commerce up to the federal level of government. again, because commerce is lifted up in the ultimate preemption of all things commerce, the federal government level, that the state government and municipal government lack the authority to be able to regulate in those areas that are deemed to be commerce, interstate commerce, that's lodged at the federal level. And that gets weaponized, of course, because, guess what? It's privately enforceable. So corporations can bring a lawsuit against your municipality for violating their commerce rights under the U.S. Constitution's Commerce Clause. So when communities contact us and they say, we want to say no to this thing coming in, we don't want it here, and we'll look back at them and say, we're with you. We wouldn't want it either. We wouldn't want to live in a community with that particular project coming in. And we would explain to them that the system of law makes it illegal and unconstitutional to say no to the corporation coming in. In essence, we have a constitutional structure in which corporations have more rights than the communities in which they do business. And that's what it comes down to. That will say to these communities, well, you can't, and here's why, because you have these rights, and if you do this, you're going to get sued by the corporation. Oh, and guess what? The corporation can not only just sue you to overturn your decision, your ordinance, whatever you've passed, but they can also sue you for damages. They can sue your municipality for damages in the form of future lost profits lost as a result of the ordinance that you've passed with at the local level, right? So there's a damage award that can come with that lawsuit. So the communities that we deal with, they, you know, they're on the other end of the phone or they're meeting with us in the office and they say, why do corporations have constitutional rights, right? Why is that? And we'll say, well, the short answer is that there's been a series of Supreme Court decisions, starting in 1819, moving up to 1886, the Santa Clara decision, which has gotten fairly popular in public discourse. Other decisions, even up to last year, where the Supreme Court and other courts are constantly expanding those civil rights protections out for corporations. And the community on the other end of the line would say, why? Why does the Supreme Court hold that corporations have rights? And we'll explain to them, well, because the U.S. Constitution itself is structured to place commerce and property rights above the rights of people, nature, and communities, because that's the basic structure of the constitutional material, that it was very easy for corporations to obtain protections in the form of corporate personhood or commerce clause or those other things. Because if you're going to protect commerce and property as the highest value within the constitutional structure and protect it the most, it makes sense that you would take the actors and vehicles that are the predominant vehicles for commerce and property, which today is the corporate form, and protect those with the highest levels of constitutional protections as well. So corporate personhood and corporate rights are not a mistake. They're not an error. They're ingrained within the constitutional structure. Because once the constitutional structure was written a certain way, it was easy pickings for the corporate lawyers to come in and actually grab those protections. So I know, you know, some folks sometimes want to treat it as an error to be fixed. Like if you get the right case up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the justices are just going to slap themselves on the forehead and say, of course we've been wrong for the last 200 years, and corporations shouldn't have these rights. I think that's insane. So it makes sense from that logical connection point. To which the communities on the other end of the phone, when we would say, well, the Constitution's built that way, and this is why it was natural to actually corporations have those protections, they would say, why is that? And we'd say, well, it's because the Constitution, in some ways, was modeled on this nasty piece of business called English common law, right? So we're an English colony. We sometimes forget that our states, not our states on the West Coast, but our states on the East Coast, started as private corporations. Virginia was a private corporation. It was established to extract the resources from what became the Virginia colony. Massachusetts Bay Colony began as a private corporation to extract resources out from what became the Massachusetts Bay Colony. That we began as private corporations in many ways. And what governed those private corporations? It was a system of law called English common law. Where did English common law come from? Well, it was a system of law that England used as an excuse to colonize other places, like the Barbados and India. It was a system of law that legalized violence against native peoples. It was the same system of law that recognized that if you set foot on a piece of property, an island somewhere, and stuck your flag in the ground, that it didn't matter who lived there before, that that land was now yours. It's called the doctrine of discovery, right? You discover it's yours. It doesn't matter what was there in the first place, but it's yours now to do with what you want. That English common law system seeped into our U.S. Constitution because the lawyers who actually wrote the U.S. Constitution, they knew English common law. That's the system under which they had been trained. And when you read the Philadelphia Constitutional Minutes, the convention minutes, you'll see the lawyers standing up saying English common law is the best system of law ever developed in the world. And we need to actually recreate it within the U.S. constitutional structure, right? So if by that time on the phone the community hadn't hung up yet as we were going through these steps, they would continue to ask these questions of why. And eventually those questions of why made it into our democracy schools. So our democracy schools are two-day trainings of lawyers and municipal officials and community leaders to understand where this thing came from. Where did this monster come from? And better yet, how do we dismantle it and build something new that's life-based rather than property and commerce-based? How do we do that, right? Unfortunately, our environmental activism over the past 45 years, I read something really, really disheartening the other day, which is the environmental movement has been around for 45 years now. Basically when we measure the years, 45 years. It's raised tens of billions of dollars into that environmental movement, into those groups. The Nature Conservancy is now worth $20 billion. Huge amounts of wealth going into these entities. Their activism, unfortunately, has been shaped by the constitutional construct. What you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. After all, if communities can't say no to a harmful project coming into their community, which, by the way, if you can't say no to a Walmart, you can't say yes to a sustainable downtown. If you can't say no to aerial pesticide spraying, you can't say yes to a sustainable, healthy environment or healthy families. There's a cost there when you can't say no. And because under the system of law we can't say no, we do everything else but say no. Right? That's what our activism has become. We basically do three things, three categories. We try to pressure decision makers to make the right decision. Right? That's one area of activism. We also work within the regulatory field to appeal permits and testify at regulatory hearings to try to get regulatory agencies to do the right decisions, or make the right decisions. And the third thing is, if we can't get what we need from the other two, we try to write new laws. We try to create new laws. The only problem is that constitutional structure, that legal structure that we have in the United States, severely limits the reach of each of those three categories of activism. They all assume that we have a democracy. Those three areas of activism assume that we live in a democratic system. So under the pressure politics arm, what do we do? Well, we write letters to our congresspeople, right, urging them to do the right thing. We write letters to our state legislature. We do protests. So we make signs and we walk up and down streets, hoping that that has an impact on elected officials and decision makers. We speak at hearings. Unfortunately, those hearings that we speak at, a lot of times the microphones aren't even connected to the regulatory agencies. Some people have called that a democracy theme park, where we think that we're actually doing something, but in reality it's set up for us to think that we're doing something when we're not. And I guess the one thing that, you know, through that first category of activism, the one thing that drives me crazy anymore is when people talk about having a seat at the table. Like the environmental groups or citizen groups will say, all we want is a seat at the table. That's all we want. We just want our voice heard. We want a seat at the table. Well, I got news for them. We own the fucking table. It's our table, right? The Declaration of Independence and all that stuff coming out of the American Revolution. It's our table. We decide who gets a beverage. We decide who gets utensils. It's our table to decide what happens at that table with those decisions made at that table. The second category of activism that we do is we try to make the environmental regulations work for us. So we have environmental regulations in place that establish requirements for different industries to comply with before they put certain projects into place. For 10 years, we attempted to enforce those environmental regulations. What happens, of course, is that the corporation puts in their permit application. environmental lawyers look at the environmental regulations that are in place and try to find gaps, omissions, and deficiencies with the permit application that's originally been put in. And I argue to the judge that section little 2 little c little 2 little I little 2 little e little 2 little I little c little e of the environmental regulations haven't been complied with by the state agency when they issued the permit to the corporation, right? That was our life for about 10 years. The problem is that the regulations themselves are written by the very corporations that ostensibly the regulations are supposed to regulate. So when I worked in the Pennsylvania legislature and did some regulatory stuff, what I would watch is the corporate lobbyists actually writing the regulatory structures and handing them off to the legislatures. If we think that we can win under that system when somebody else is writing the script under which our activism is carried out, we are the crazy ones. The definition of insanity is trying to do the same thing over and over again and hoping for a different result each time. Why in the world would the corporations and the industries build in something for us within the regulations that they're writing themselves for their own industry, right? Why would that happen? It wouldn't. Yet our defense when these projects come in is based on those very same regulations, that regulatory structure. Somebody much smarter than me at one point said, the only thing that environmental regulations regulate are environmentalists. Because they make us predictable in our defense when we try to fight a project on the ground that's gone through that regulatory process. And even worse, as if things need to get worse, is that the monies that the corporations spend on defending those permit issuances is tax deductible. Right? So at least we thought for 10 years while we were going in and fighting these regulatory fights and dragging the corporation that we were at least costing the corporation money. But it turns out that the tax code recognizes the money that they spend in defense of those permits as tax deductible, as reasonable and necessary business expenses under the law. So that third category of stuff that we try to do is basically create new laws. The problem is that when we try to create new laws, they're subject to the constitutional doctrines that can be used to strike them down. So the new laws that we draft generally coming out of environmental organizations and breaching into the legislative process are so milquetoast that they deal with disclosure stuff generally. You just have to disclose stuff before you go ahead and gut our community. You just have to let the public know. Right to know laws, disclosure laws, that's what you see coming out of this stuff. And there's a reason for that, because the framing of the goals of those laws is done in a milquetoast way because they know that nothing else will pass legal muster as it moves through the process in the system. So there's a reason why that those are limited in their effect. Yeah, you know, I gave one of these talks last year, and some guy got really upset and came up to, you know, he raised his hand at the end during the Q&A session. He said, when I said the phrase, which I do often, that we are worse off today than we were 40 years ago when the major environmental laws were passed. We're worse off now today than we were 40 years ago when those laws were passed. And he said, well, that's not true. That's not true. You know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we had rivers catching on fire. And that's true. In Ohio, we had rivers catching on fire with toxic waste and everything else. And I said back to him, I said, well, if that's our measure of success at this point, is rivers not catching on fire, then we've got real problems. Because I think our standard should be a little higher than that, that we don't have rivers catching on fire. So what does all this mean? Well, it means that we have essentially been placed as the public and our communities in a box of allowable activism. You know, it's a square. And on the outside of that square are actually these legal doctrines which control what we can and can't do. Basically defining allowable activism that we can engage in. And generally that means regulatory stuff, disclosure laws, types of things that we've talked about, because they don't run afoul of those doctrines. You know, corporate rights doctrine, preemption doctrine, those types of things. The question we need to ask ourselves is if we continue within that box, you know, from a 30,000 foot level, if we continue within that box, is it possible to attain economic and environmental sustainability by working in that box? That's the question, right? And the answer, at least, the answer to us at least, is no. And the second question that we need to ask ourselves is from below, not from the 30,000 foot level, but from below, Should our communities have the right to say no to these corporate projects? A democratic question. Should there be a democratic system operating that allows communities to veto these projects, to actually not allow them to come into the community? And it was those two questions that drove the first community rights-based laws in the United States. They came out of South Central Pennsylvania, which had been targeted with about a dozen corporate hog factory farms to come into one very small county in South Central Pennsylvania. We went through all of this with that community. Elected officials and farmers there came to us and said, we don't want these things. And we went through our process and we said, well, you know, you can't say no to them. You have to allow them. And something cracked there. I'm still not sure what it was. I've seen it many, many times over, including here in Oregon and Coos and Lincoln and Columbia and different places that are starting to do rights-based organizing. But I think what happened was the cost of doing nothing at that point became more expensive than the cost of doing something. Because they knew if they sat on their asses and actually listened to this structure of law, if they obeyed this system of law and its dictates, that they were going to get corporatized, that their agriculture was going to get corporatized, their landscapes were going to be ruined, their community quality of life was going to be ruined, all those things. And I think that they weren't willing to sit down for that, but instead said, we need to challenge the whole enchilada. And I think that's basically what's happening in a lot of these communities. They became the first ones to pass an ordinance banning corporate factory farms within their communities. So they said, screw you to the box. And don't tell us we need to color within the lines of the box. We're going to move outside the box, and we're going to accept the ramifications, and we're going to put up a fight, right? Because they understood that the option on the other side wasn't really an option. What was fascinating to us as we were moving through this process was that as soon as they passed the law, they got sued. Should be no surprise after what we've talked about tonight. And the lawsuit raised corporate constitutional rights issues about the ordinances that they had been passing. And because the ordinances raised corporate constitutional rights issues, the fight quickly transformed from one that was focused on agriculture and factory farms and parts per million and water pollution, air pollution, all those things that come with factory farms, and began to transform into one of corporations. That corporate rights was an issue, that preemption was an issue, because those are the counts that were brought by the corporation against this particular municipality in that lawsuit. And what happened next became the stories that the community rights movement has been built upon, which is that two small communities, also in Pennsylvania, said to themselves, well, all of our laws are at risk from this corporate rights situation. These corporate rights existing can be used to come down and overturn what we've drafted within our community. And they began working to draft an ordinance that stripped corporations of constitutional rights within their municipality. Okay? So not an abstract academic concept, but saying we need to protect our people here from corporate factory farms and land applied sludge and some of the other issues that were being faced by municipalities. And they began to think structurally, to evolve to a structural critique of the system and begin to hack, you know, at the very basic level of those corporate rights piece, you know, to redefine the problem away from the environmental issues and instead begin to reframe the problem about corporate rights. What was fascinating to me after those passed, and those were the first in the nation municipalities to refuse to accord corporations constitutional rights within their locality, is that the corporations reacted by going to the state legislature and getting a preemptive bill passed that prohibited those laws from being adopted or enforced. So just to take a deep breath here, because I think this was a big moment, at least for us, working with the community rights stuff. The bill that the legislature passed, while in place a liberal Democratic governor, whose name was Ed Rendell, so this is the liberal Democrats joining with the Republicans to put something through the legislature. The bill was called ACRE. And what it did was it set up a process for affected corporations, so agribusiness corporations affected by these ordinances being passed by municipalities, to pick up the phone and call the state attorney general's office, who would then sue the municipalities for violating the state law. Okay. So again, just to take a moment to pause on that part for a moment. These are state taxpayer monies being used to fund the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office now on the hook for corporations calling into their office to bring a lawsuit against these municipal communities, the people within the communities who dared to say no to corporate hog factory farms. And the lawsuit is not brought by the corporation, it's brought by the state. So it's Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus you, right? The municipality, people of the municipality. People always look back at this period of time and say, oh my God, that's horrible. That's horrible. I can't even think about that, really, wrap my head around it. To which, in some ways, it was a good thing because people up to that time, and I think people everywhere, tend to describe the problem as corporations, that corporations are the problem, you know, the trying to put this, that, or whatever into the community. But it's not just the corporations. It's your state. It's your system of government, which in some ways, you know, runs as a one-way pipe towards this endless production of more, towards commerce, towards helping the corporation do what it needs to do. Most of these corporations can't come into our communities unless they have the backing of the state, unless they have a permit, unless they have some kind of permission from the state. They're not called permits for nothing. They permit harms to occur, right? That's what permits do. That's what permits legalize. They legalize these harms within these communities. So at about the same time as these ordinances were moving in Pennsylvania, eventually 100 communities in Pennsylvania would pass these ordinances. 10% of all rural communities in the state of Pennsylvania rose up in revolt against the state, basically saying to the state, you have no control over what we do here. You can't tell us that we can't raise our standards here. You can't tell us that we can't put greater protections in place than are established by other areas of law. That is, all this was happening, some rural communities were talking with us about the fact that we have no real environmental protection in the United States. Because environmental protection in the United States is predicated on nature being property. And this is one of the hardest, most difficult concepts we deal with. But if you own a 10-acre piece of land in the United States, and you have a deed to that 10-acre piece of land, and barring some special circumstance of a wetland or endangered species or something on that that piece of land, that deed carries with it the legal authority to destroy the ecosystems on that piece of land that you own. We don't have a recognition in this country that nature or ecosystems have rights of their own. So ecosystem rights, we're not even used to thinking of it that way because we have a property-based system of environmental protection. Well, a lot of these communities were saying it's impossible to protect nature when the more money you have, the more land you can buy, and the more land you can buy, the more nature you can destroy, which is basically how this system is predicated in the United States. And so these small communities, not liberal progressive communities, these are conservative, rural, Republican communities in the south central part of the state of Pennsylvania, began passing these laws, which explode our brains sometimes, but they declared that nature had the right to exist within the community, that ecosystems had the right to exist within the community. And to blow our brains even more, those small Pennsylvania communities, the story of those small Pennsylvania communities, got out through the media all the way to Ecuador. And the Ecuadorians were writing a new constitution. And they were printing down these media reports from what was happening in Pennsylvania about the rights of nature stuff. And they contacted us and they flew us down to Ecuador, to Quito, to meet with the constitutional delegates who wanted to write rights of nature into their national constitution. The National Ecuadorian Constitution. And we helped them to write that language. And they put it into their constitution. And by popular referendum, they adopted it in, becoming the first country in the world to actually transform from a property-based environmental protection system to a rights-based environmental protection system. And perhaps to burst our brains even more, we just had the first enforcement cases brought under those Ecuadorian constitutional provisions. One of the cases was captioned the Vilcabamba River versus the province of Loja, because the local government had been doing road construction and been dumping road construction debris into the river, thus altering its flow. And a couple who lived along the river used the constitutional provisions to actually step into the shoes of the river to bring the suit, the river as a plaintiff, right? And the judge ruled in favor of the river in that case, right? So talk about a new paradigm that's starting to take place. You know, we use the phrase community self-determination. It's not just the community of people that need to have self-determination. It's also the ecosystems and nature that need some degree of self-determination. So this work began to spread in Pennsylvania, began to spread to New Hampshire. We began to support its work by doing these democracy schools and working with communities to attempt to help them to draft new laws and to defend those laws, which is what we do today. In Oregon, we have all of these counties, people within these counties, moving to do rights-based organizing work. So not just here in Lincoln, but also Benton, Josephine, Lane, Columbia, a bunch of other counties working together, as was said earlier, in the Oregon Community Rights Network. So these communities have now come together. In fact, the other day we had a day-long meeting with the group, but this Oregon Community Rights Network, composed of these communities, now moving forward to be a statewide force on community rights and rights-based organizing. We have 10 states. We have 200 communities in 10 states now that have passed rights-based ordinances. So rights-based local laws, charters in some places, ordinances in others, town meeting warrant articles in New Hampshire, where they actually come together once a year, all the residents of the town, to vote on warrant articles, which are basically ordinances. But democracy seems to be breaking out, you know, despite the best attempts to corral it in these places. The local ordinances do three things. They create a community bill of rights that recognizes that people and ecosystems in some places actually have rights, civil, political, and environmental rights, and expand those beyond the state and federal Bill of Rights. Then they ban activities like, I don't know, just to pick an activity, aerial pesticide spraying, that would violate those rights put forward in the Community Bill of Rights. And then they insulate the ordinances. They assume that corporations are going to sue. This isn't about us cowering in the corner saying, please don't come after us. This is an open invitation, an open confrontation, a carefully scripted confrontation to force the corporation to come after the community if they choose to do so in a certain way that has to validate the doctrines of corporate rights and preemption, these other things. It's our thinking that most people in the United States believe that they live in a democracy, right? This work is about showing them that they don't, right? And it's not showing them that they don't by giving flashy speeches or traveling around and giving lectures. It's actually about communities confronting those corporations in a very real confrontation, in a very real, direct, imminent way, and then allowing those confrontations to begin to show thousands of people at a time that they don't live in a democratic system. Our strategy is twofold. Number one, it's going into the courts. So we go into the courts and argue to judges that a right to local self-governance exists, that the community has exercised that right in passing a local law, and that the doctrine of corporate rights and preemption are unconstitutional because they violate the right of local self-governance. That's the argument we make to the courts. We have 80-page briefs that look at the history of the United States and make that argument. But it's very important to declare at this point, in many ways, that we don't think that the courts are necessarily going to be the change agent. The courts are the ones that introduce these doctrines in the first place. Corporate rights, preemption. Preemption is purely a judicial doctrine. We don't think the judiciary is going to be the change agent in most of these places. Although I have to say I've been surprised from time to time. Last year, a judge in Western Pennsylvania issued a 35-page ruling declaring that corporations were not persons for parts of the Pennsylvania Constitution's Bill of Rights. I don't think that would have happened 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but things like that are starting to pop. The reason for the state CRNs, in large part, are to begin to draft state constitutional amendments that actually use the state mechanism, state government structure, to protect the right of communities to adopt rights-based laws. And so a couple weeks ago, the Oregon Community Rights Amendment, Oregon Community Rights Network filed a state constitutional amendment that does exactly that. It recognizes a right of local self-governance. It then empowers people within communities to adopt laws pursuant to that right. And then there's a limiting factor within the amendment that says passing any law is not okay. You can only pass laws that do not drop below the floor of state and federal constitutional and statutory protections. So it's very important to understand that this amendment opens the ground up for a certain kind of lawmaking to take place, a rights-based lawmaking that builds on the floor of existing state and federal constitutional protections but can't drop below those protections. So it's a one-way pipe that the amendment attempts to create. In addition, the state CRNs, the community rights networks across the United States, and there are six functioning CRNs now in addition to Oregon, have come together to create the National Community Rights Network. The National Community Rights Network meets next month to approve a federal constitutional amendment that would recognize the right of local self-governance as a federally protected right. Okay, so alignment between all the different levels, the local, the state, and the federal. I have to say, you know, before I finish up tonight, we've learned some lessons over the past 15 years. And those lessons have been hard-earned, hard-won. We're now sharing them with these communities that are moving through the same process that we've moved through over the years. One is that constitutional change is necessary. We've come to the conclusion that nothing less than changing the source code is necessary in the United States. We have a constitution that worked very well in the 1780s. Doesn't work so well now in terms of the environmental problems and issues that we are confronted with. The other thing that's become clear is that if we're all about changing the Constitution eventually and driving that challenge from below, that only movements change constitutions. And right now, you know, if quizzed, I think we would say, well, no movement really exists yet. The beginnings of a movement exist. So disparate communities and disparate places trying to come together and figure this stuff out and then decide what to do. But our lodestar in some ways for what defines a movement are really the prior movements that arose in the United States. So the abolitionists and the suffragists, for example. The abolitionists in the 1800s, early 1800s, 60 years the abolitionists operated, to change African Americans from being a thing or property under the system of law to being persons under the law. The suffragists acted for, in some ways, 80 years to actually shift women from being property to women being persons and rights-bearing entities, at least for purposes of the suffrage. So the 19th Amendment, when that was driven into place. We sometimes forget that corporations became persons in 1886 through the U.S. Supreme Court decision. Women didn't become persons for purposes of the suffrage until 1920. So 40 years after corporations became persons under the system of law, that women obtained some personhood rights through the system. So I think that's important to recognize. What the abolition of the suffragists did in moving things into being persons is kind of what we're talking about here. Our municipal communities right now are property of the state. The state controls you. They tell you what to do, what you can't do. If tomorrow the Oregon legislature wanted to abolish Newport as a municipal corporation, there's nothing in the Constitution that says they can't. So they have plenary power over the municipal corporations across the state of Oregon. And the final thing to say is that the abolitionists and the suffragists ran into opposition as well. Milk toast groups who were about things other than abolishing slavery, and milquetoast groups that were about things other than granting full equal rights to women when they arose. And there had to be some elbow throwing between those groups. In some ways, the community rights movement thinks that that elbow throwing has to be done to large environmental organizations, other large entities that have perfected the regulatory approach and continue to feed communities into that shredder, that we've become very pointed in our criticism of how those large groups operate, and we think a different path is necessary. I'm not willing to give them another 45 years to continue the traditional activism that's gotten us to this place. None of it's personal. These are all good people with good hearts standing on the front lines in these different groups, but they're in the way, and we have to be clear about that, taking them on grounds of strategy rather than attacking them personally. In some ways, we have to become unapologetic when we move at the local level, even though everybody says we can't. So the law professors will come out and say, you can't ban aerial pesticide spraying. Judges may eventually say that. All of the important people within the United States will be saying that over the next couple of years and have said that before. And most of that is in some ways tied to the liberal progressives in the United States, the conventional liberal progressives, who wring their hands when places like Lincoln County stand up and say, you're going to ban aerial pesticide spraying. They wring their hands and they say things like, it's too much too soon. And we can't have communities with that kind of power. Well, they were saying the same thing about the abolitionists and the suffragists. So you're in good company in that place. So two quotes tonight to finish this out, and then I'm going to turn it over to the Lincoln County group to talk about the local initiative and what's happening here. I think we have three challenges. We have to understand the full scope of the problem that we face, right? It's not just about parts per million or air pollution or those types of things. It's actually structural. That we live in a system that doesn't allow us to move towards sustainability. That in some ways sustainability is illegal under this system of law. We need to frame a commensurate solution, actually come together and talk with each other about becoming lawmakers and policymakers and what does that look like and frame a solution. And then we actually need to get to work to build a new kind of activism that helps us claim the legal authority to take that commensurate solution that we've come up with and framed and actually drive it into law. And the first quote tonight of the two that I want to read to back up the three-part harmony is a Derek Jensen quote. I don't know whether anybody knows Derek Jensen. He's an author, Pacific Northwest. Yes, that's great. Derek likes to say that what we need to do is give up hope, right? And people say, what do you mean, give up hope? You can't give up hope. Hope is what keeps us going, right? Hope that something else is possible. Well, Derek says that in reality, when we have hope on something, it's essentially hope that someone else is going to save us. That a regulatory agency is going to save us, that the state legislature is going to step in. I was at a meeting last week where somebody said, all we need to do is get a packet of information to Senator Elizabeth Warren. And I was like, what the hell do you think Senator Warren's going to do for you, right? It's not going to stop whatever's happening in your community. She's one person, even if she wanted to. Anyway, Derek says that giving up hope, quote, makes you more effective because you cease relying on someone or something else to solve your problems. You cease hoping your problems would somehow get solved through the magical assistance of God, the Great Mother, the Sierra Club, or even the Earth itself. And you just begin doing whatever it takes to solve those problems yourself. And the second quote is from Sam Smith, a friend of mine from Washington, D.C., who wrote a book, which I turn to from time to time. It's called Why Bother? Right? After we know the scope of this problem and the height of the mountain and what we have to climb, you know, he wrote this book back in the 80s called Why Bother? And this is what he said at the end of that book. He said, our predicament makes life simpler. We have clearly lost what we have lost. We can give up our futile efforts to preserve the illusion and turn our energies instead to the construction of a new time. It is this willingness to walk away from the seductive power of the present that first divides the mere reformer from the rebel. Above all, we must understand that in leaving the toxic ways of the present, we are healing ourselves, our places, and our planet. We rebel not as a last act of desperation, but as a first act of creation. Thank you.
You have heard Thomas Lindsay speak now, speak about the need for structural change in our government system. We must come together to stem the overbearing power of corporations using our right and authority to govern. Our government is meant to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. For us, the travesty of corporate personhood, of money being equated to speech, of allowing unlimited amounts of that kind of speech to influence our elections on all major legislative decisions, thereby silencing the voice of the people, has led to dire consequences. We, the National Community Rights Network and the Oregon Community Rights Network, are organized to work towards counteracting the power of corporations by putting ordinances on the ballot that ban specific harms that corporations are inflicting on our communities. In Oregon, we have 6 counties in community rights initiatives. Lane County is working on local food rights and aerial pesticide spray. Lincoln County is working to ban aerial pesticide spray in our county. Coos County is trying to stop an LNG pipeline and terminal in their county. Columbia County is working to stop the passage of coal and oil trains through that county. Douglas County, like Coos County, is trying to stop the passage of an LNG pipeline through that county. And Benton County is exploring ordinances on local food systems, aerial pesticide spray, and worker rights. 2 other counties besides Lincoln are working on or have filed ordinances banning aerial pesticide spraying, a widespread problem that has been poisoning us and our ecosystems for many years. Pesticides were invented as poisons to fight wars. Today, they're being used to grow forests and to grow food. We, willing or not, are the consumers of foods that have been drenched in poisons to grow them and lately also to harvest them. The EPA, rather than regulate to protect people and the environment from harm, acts as the voice of government facilitating each new pesticide's entry into the market. Our ordinance is written to protect Lincoln County from the harms done by aerial spraying of pesticides to people, wildlife, and ecosystems. There are many ordinances in effect in our county doing many different things. There is no ordinance to protect us from the harms caused by aerially sprayed pesticides, which drift in the air, are carried in wind and rain, enter our waterways with runoff after rainstorms, penetrate our soil, poison the food that our wildlife eats, including the fish in our streams, and slowly but surely poison us too. Degenerative diseases such as cancer, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, autoimmune diseases, and many others are all on the rise since the advent of massive aerially sprayed pesticides on our watersheds and crops. Other forms of pesticide application also cause harm, including those used in households, parks, and roadsides. Our current ordinance deals with aerially sprayed pesticides only. This ordinance addresses the fact that Lincoln County's population is concentrated on the coast at the base of watersheds. There are also many people living right in the forest, people whose water comes from springs and wells that are easily contaminated by aerially sprayed pesticides. Neither federal, state, nor local laws protect us from this kind of toxic trespass promoted and carried out by timber and chemical companies whose owners and officials do not live here and do not suffer the consequences of pesticide application over large areas of land in our county. We believe that aerial spraying of pesticides is not necessary because the task of eliminating weeds and competing vegetation after tree planting, which is the purpose of for which aerial spraying of pesticides is undertaken, can also be accomplished through manual action without the use of any pesticides, without contaminating the environment, and without endangering the safety and of all life in it, while at the same time creating many direly needed jobs for our community. Our ordinance establishes that all people of Lincoln County, along with natural communities and ecosystems within the county, possess the right to be free of aerially sprayed pesticides. It also establishes the right of the people of the county to a system of government that protects and secures their human, civil, and collective rights. All governments in the United States owe their existence to the people of the communities that those governments serve. Their function is to secure and protect the rights of those people. and any system of government that becomes destructive of those ends is not legitimate, lawful, or constitutional. Our ordinance establishes prohibitions to secure the rights that it reconfirms and makes it unlawful for any corporation to violate any secured right in that by the ordinance. I say rights that the ordinance reconfirms because we already have those rights, but they're not being honored. Our ordinance also establishes enforcement of this provision by any court possessing jurisdiction over activities occurring within Lincoln County. Lincoln County or any resident of Lincoln County may enforce the rights and prohibition of this ordinance by filing legal action against corporate violators of the ordinance in such a court. Damages incurred in violations are measured by the cost of restoring the ecosystem or natural community to its state before the injury. That cost must be paid to Lincoln County to be used exclusively for the full and complete restoration of the ecosystem or natural community. Our ordinance also says that corporations who violate this ordinance shall not be deemed to be persons, to the extent that such treatment would interfere with the rights or prohibitions enumerated by the ordinance. It is also important to know that what our ordinance would not do, regardless of the statements by those who are challenging it. The ordinance would not prohibit other forms of pesticide application. It would not prohibit general use of pesticides, including their use in homes and gardens. It would not prohibit any use of pesticides by private persons, and it would not prohibit clear cutting. We have filed our ordinance. The relevant county authorities have approved it. We were ready to gather the necessary signatures for it. However, a private citizen of the county has challenged it, filing a lawsuit against the ballot title published in the News Times and claiming non-compliance with several Oregon statutes. The ordinance is in compliance with those statutes. However, the lawsuit has been filed and we have to win it before we can be authorized to collect signatures to put our ordinance on the ballot. At this point, we have been assigned a judge, but are still waiting to be assigned a hearing date. The lawsuit alone may cost us up to $3,500. Some of you have already donated, and we thank you with all our hearts for your generosity. We cannot achieve our goal of a county in which we are protected from the harms of aerially sprayed pesticides without help from everyone. We need your help in working with us to bring our message to more people. We also need it to cover many ongoing expenses, such as the lawsuit, printing, copying, renting venues for events, paying for the cost of bringing knowledgeable speakers to our county, etc. Our challenge is a very big one, in which we must persist in time. Only by acting together can we rise above the power of corporations. They count on the power of money to support them. We must be able to count on the power of our numbers. We are the people. Our work is a step in a struggle to reclaim our hijacked democracy. The Roman Emperor Caligula made his horse a senator. Romans knew that he was crazy. We know that corporations are not persons. We must act on that knowledge and reclaim our democracy by elevating the constitutional rights of persons of flesh and blood in our communities above the invented rights of corporations treated as persons. We, meaning all counties active in community rights in Oregon, are also involved in a statewide effort to amend the Constitution of Oregon to give us the right to local community self-government in all matters that pertain to our fundamental rights to safety and well-being. Some of you probably remember signing petitions for that initiative and remember that the first 1,000 signatures we were seeking to collect at the time were needed so the state would look at our amendment proposal and decide whether to authorize us to gather the remaining 139,000 signatures. The state did not authorize us to gather more signatures. According to our attorneys, its reasons for that can be counter-argued in court. Rather than spending time and money on a lengthy court process at this point, the Oregon Community Rights Network decided that it would be better to change a few minor details in the wording of the amendment to give it a better chance to be approved. The new wording is now finished. The slightly revised document has been filed, and we have been authorized to gather the first 1,000 signatures once more. To those of you who signed before, we apologize for the inconvenience. We need your signatures again. Petitions are on the table by the sink in the back of this room. Finally, we now want to invite you to ask some questions about what Thomas Lindsay has spoken. And after that, we invite you to come to our information and donation tables. We have sign-up sheets ready for you so we can send you information on our work via email. We have copies of our ordinance, and we have petition sheets for our constitutional amendment ready to be signed. If you would like to volunteer to help us with our work, you can mark that column in our sign-up sheet. We need you. The booklet entitled On Community Rights and Civil Disobedience in the Name of Sustainability, written by Thomas Lindsay, is available to you for a donation of $10 or more. Thomas will be at the table to autograph your book. Please donate as generously as you can. Thank you.